Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the stations of KHOI Community Radio in downtown Ames. Fall has fallen upon us. I think the appropriate term for fall is the day that you go out the door and leaves really are like falling in buckets today. There's enough of a breeze.
Oh, boy. But everything's still a lot of green still.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty. Sunshine. But we have a nip in the air, and it's time. Here it is in central Iowa, being October. Yes, it is.
The frost is on the pumpkin.
Oh, which is how it should be.
Yeah.
All right. Well, for those of us who eat meat, there is more and more concern about where that meat comes from and
what kind of life that animal
has
led.
What kind of life? There has been quite a bit of talk and legislation and quite a bit of hoo-ha about something in California called Proposition 12, which has to do with how we treat pork. It seems
pigs.
It seems that there's a lot of concern about how pigs are raised, and people seem to have different opinions.
Well, it's not just in California. I mean, the problem is they don't really raise pigs in California, so they're buying the pigs from elsewhere, largely which come from Iowa. And we have these same issues in Iowa. You know, there's ongoing legislation trying to control or reduce the confinement animal feed operations. So this was a sort of a little pot shot at that. It's very hard to legislate these things, apparently.
It seems quite complicated.
Yes. So Prop 12 in California wants to eliminate gestation, eliminate the market in California only for pork grown in gestation crates. So we have a nice, good Iowa farmer with us today to talk about these issues. It's John Gilbert, who is on a 125-year-old.
He's not 125.
No. The farm. Gilbert Farm. So it's called Gibraltar Farms, right, John?
That's correct.
Yeah. So it's a multi-generation, been going on long enough that John knows whereof he speaks, and he raises pigs for Nyman Ranch, been doing it. You were one of the earliest Nyman Ranch farmers in Iowa. And tell us what a gestation crate is.
Well, I, you know, can't speak from experience because we've never used them, but they are a stall, a cage, a metal enclosure that is just big enough for, you know, a full-grown sow to stand in, stand up and lay down in. They use these, you know, my understanding is because they're pulling sows out of what they call farrowing crates, where they have their babies and where they nurse them for 2 to 3 weeks. When they pull them out of there, they don't have any social cohesion in a group. And so then their way of trying to control any kind of, you know, aggression in a social group is to just put them back in another cage. And so, that's what a gestation crate is. Feed comes in the front, and the waste is supposed to fall through the cracks in the back, and they're supposed to stay in there for roughly 4 months it takes between when they finish one nursing one group of pigs and when they're ready to farrow the next time.
So while sows are in the gestation crate, their one and only job is to nurse the litter of pigs that they may. So that's their job, and it's kind of like forced labor.
Wait, it's after they've nursed, right, John?
Well, the farrowing crates are where they are supposed to give birth and then nurse their pigs.
Ah.
And it's a little bit bigger, but it's the same kind of. And anybody who's been to the state fair and seen the pork producer exhibit there in the livestock barn where they try to have, you know, baby pigs being born all the time. That's you know, what they're using there is considered a farrowing crate or a farrowing stall. And a gestation crate is essentially that, except there's no creep areas on either side. And so the side of one stall, you know, becomes the side of the next stall to it. So they're kind of all just side by side. And so they end up with, you know, rows of sows that are basically literally cheek by jowl,
and they're
separated
while they're pregnant.
Little barns. This is after they're weaned and where they get bred, and then until they get ready to farrow again.
And it's, so, tell us how you do it, so that you don't have to do that.
You know, the way it was always done, and you know, and the way we still do it, you know, in the industrial system, they're using artificial insemination, which basically means that, you know, humans are coming along and actually impregnating the sows. The natural way is that, you know, you use a boar. Boars are males, you know, and so their job is to, you know, breed the females. And, you know, that's the system we've used. And because we farrow in groups, in free-ranging groups, we use, you know, what is called an A house. It's just a little wooden structure with, you know, metal sheeting on it that provides, you know, provides the sow and her pigs shelter. A way to get isolated and away from each other. You know, and these are designed, you know, ours are designed so they can be spread in a pasture, and the sows can pick their own, and there is a door on them to try and, you know, help maintain climate control and weather, you know, when it gets a little chilly. And but they can come and go as they please. They quickly learn to open and close the door as they go in and out. And when it gets warm, why we fasten the doors open, you know, so that they the little pigs can eventually come out of the hut and learn to run around with their mothers. So, you know, because they are in a socially cohesive group all the time, we very seldom have much problems with aggression. And the other thing that we have, you know, when you're outside in the open air, is you can allow more room. And so, you know, if you're going to build a building, put a roof in, put cement pits and floor in, why, you're going to be very stingy on the amount of space you provide. And that's really the critical factor here, is that, you know, animals will get along quite well when they have, you know, room to, you know, get away from each other, or to know their place in a social hierarchy.
Well, and isn't this the way pigs used to be raised? Like, when I was a child, all the fields were full of the little A-frames with the pigs running around.
Well, that's, you're right. That's the traditional system. And you know, a lot of times people would farrow in those, you know, in the summertime, and then in the wintertime, they would have a building with pens in them where, you know, essentially very similar. But, you know, it was very common for, you know, and even when I was growing up, that's the way we did it. We would let the, you know, let the sows out of the pens or the stalls wherever we were farrowing them to eat in groups, so that they always had that, you know, that social connection.
There's the people that are think about eating meat and maybe some that have decided not to eat meat realize that animals are a lot more than just protein. You talk about socially cohesive groups. They have families, but they work work things out together. They have brains. They work
pigs,
things
pigs are
out.
Actually very smart, aren't they, John?
Yeah. So it sounds like having more room to move around and air and blue skies to look at. It seems a bit would be a bit more pleasant for a pig than in a building all the time.
Well, opinion we have, and quite frankly, we came to this system for economics. When we started, raising pigs again, we'd raised pigs off and on a good portion of my life all the time I was growing up. That was one of the things I did, was a lot of the chores with the pigs and the sows. But there was a time when the sons were mainly gone, the dad quit raising pigs and we resumed that, basically coming through the farm crisis. We quickly learned that what we needed was, not more expenses, but more income. And so, we kind of resurrected a lot of the old facilities we had, left from 20, 25 years before and started raising a few pigs. And so we really didn't want to spend very much on, any kind of thing that we had to pay for, in the way of facilities. And so...
you mean you didn't want to build a million-dollar hog confinement building?
Well, those were just starting to come in, and so we actually realized we could build an A-frame in feral sows and use electric fence and keep them on grass pretty cheaply, and so that's really kind of how we got started with this system.
Now, before Paul Willis set up the Nyman Ranch Protocol, which is the kind of pigs that you raise, and you get a premium for them. How did you sell your pigs? Just right into the commodity market?
Well, if you go back, and you don't have to go back that far, because you go back into the 90s, there was still what I'm going to call a competitive market place for pigs. And, that's one of the things that really... irritated me to no end, was at the time that, industrialization was coming in. The pork producers, kept preaching, oh, you've got to be competitive. You've got to be competitive. Farmers have to be competitive. That was their way of telling people, to either get big or get out.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were missing was that it's not the farmer that should be competitive. It's the marketplace that should be competitive. But the only way industrialization works, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's hogs or dairy or, poultry or anything else, is if they can destroy the competitive market, because their cost, they have to be able to control from end to end. And if there's the variable of a competitive market, why they're not willing to take that risk. And so at that point, we were still able to get, a decent commodity price, but that quickly evaporated once we got very far into the 90s, so that's kind of how by the late 90s we were lucky enough to be able to join Nyman.
Did you already know Paul when he was beginning to try to figure out how to market this stuff?
Well,
Paul Willis.
We have been involved with Practical Farmers of Iowa for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard him speak, two or three years before when he was in the early stages of trying to get things set up. And, so it wasn't until we built our first hoop that I really talked to him about it. And, he was gracious enough to, come by in March of 98 and, take a look at, what we were doing you know, some of the people from San Francisco and some, the Halversons from the Animal Welfare Institute. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of our introduction to, to the Nyman process at that point.
So can you kind of define the Nyman process for those who aren't familiar with farming? What makes the Nyman Ranch pork different?
Well, the company has always said that they're trying to raise the highest quality and best tasting meats, but they raise it humanely and sustainably. And they've maintained from the beginning that we don't use antibiotics. And so, that was a big hurdle. The protocols that we use regulate on how much space, regulate on, the fact that, we don't use any animal byproducts in the feeds, that we don't use farrowing crates. I mean, there's a restriction on the kind of things that we have to use. And so what has happened, people have quickly figured out that you have to have a special kind of pig. You have to have a pig that is going to have some fat, and thereafter intermuscular fat. And they're going to want a pig that has, I'm going to say a more pleasant disposition. They're mm-hmm. they're not going to be as aggressive. They're going to be, we've all got the relatives in our families where you may have one aunt that's a little more plump and a little more jolly, and you have another aunt that maybe is a little thinner and sometimes can be a little jumpier and a little higher strung. And so, pigs are very much the same way. And when you have, some body fat, that means you can withstand differences in temperatures. It means that you're probably going to have a little less high strung disposition. And, there's been enough science done over the years to know, and Temple Grandin, points this out very well, that, the whiter an animal, the finer the bone the animal, and the more upright the ears are on the animal, and that applies to everything, including, with the exception of horses, because horses all have upright ears, but it still applies, the others still apply, that they're going to have a greater fear response. And so, by having, making selections, in the other direction, you can actually, end up with an animal that's going to have less stress response in everyday life. And as we all know, and we read every day, what happens in our guts has a lot to do with the rest of our, our biological system, whether it's our, metal processes, or whether it's our response to, pathogens, through our immune system. Our guts are extremely important, and stress is one of the hardest things on our gut microbiome. And pigs are very, very similar, in their biology to humans. And so, the less stress an animal has, the higher level health it will normally maintain. And so those are the principles that, go into a lot of what makes, Nyman Ranch, animals different. But what really makes Nyman Ranch different is that it is, although it is a company and it is a business, it is a family, and they have worked very hard to, maintain the approach that, the farmers have to do well. The farmers have to, be, taken care of, in order for them to be able to take care of their animals. And when they do that, then the company will do all right. And so, those are principles that a lot of companies will, espouse early on in their, you know, their development, but very few of them, you know, actually can maintain them when, you know, when the rubber meets the road and, you know, you're, as they say, up to your waist in alligators. So.
Very good.
But Nyman Ranch has managed for to have a good market to pay a premium to the farmers. And, you know, it's a very stable business model at this point. And Nyman Ranch is compliant with the current Proposition 12 in California. So Nyman Ranch meat, and there are other companies also that are compliant. Apparently, there is enough meat to satisfy the California market, whereas we're at the Supreme Court now with this decision of whether or not this law can stand. And so the Pork Producers Association, if I have the right organization, is saying that, you know, they're just not going to eat bacon in California. Well, is this true, John?
Well, I can't speak for Californians because there's a lot of things about Californians that I'll never understand, but that's another whole issue. I know Donna, you're a California expat, so.
I'm a Midwestern girl, but I lived in California for a while, and yeah, they like bacon in California just as much as anywhere else.
You know, and so, what they're probably going to do is end up paying a little more for, you know, what they buy, but, you know, that, I think you have to understand that in 2018, when 63% of the California voters, you know, approved that proposition, that they understood that.
You know,
I can't believe that they didn't, that many people didn't vote for it and not understand that. And so, you know, there's the old 10-20-70 rule that I think we need to keep in mind. And I think that, you know, that explains a lot of what, you know, what Nyman has built their business on. And that's that 10% of the people will go to great lengths to get what they want, and 20% will do it when it's convenient, and the other 70%, just like in a bell curve, don't really care. And so, you know, the Californians are probably in that same kind of category there, but they may tend a little toward the higher end of that bell curve.
So, as I understand this, Proposition 12, which was voted on, it has to do with how pigs are treated, how pigs are, how they're raised. But, and it sounds like there's different ways to raise pigs. So why are the big pork producers complaining?
Why did they take this to the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, the egg producers fought a number of years ago when Californians required more space for laying hens. You know, they couldn't put as many hens in their battery cages. You know, they fought that and it got turned down, but I'm sure they're hoping that, you know, with the more conservative appointees to the court, that they may get a better hearing. But you know, it's going to be interesting because, you know, although I certainly have no legal experience or expertise, and so I'm just another observer. You know, the court has ruled more on states' rights, and so it'll be interesting to see what they come back with. But anyway, the real issue is that the industrial system, like I said, had to destroy the competitive market. You know, and they want everybody to believe that there is no other, you know, no other way to raise pigs besides their way. And so any attack on that, you know, they're basically going to say, you know, is going to be the end of the world. Well, you know, anytime you're dealing with structural issues, having to make changes in those does seem like the end of the world. So, you know, to them, I'm sure it is considered an existential threat.
We're talking to John Gilbert about raising pork and the questions that are being raised, too, all the way to the Supreme Court. We are going to come back to talk more to John, but first I want to remind you, this is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about raising pork and some questions that it's raising about who gets to tell who about what pork to buy, which is kind of complicated, but our guest, John Gilbert, mentioned, this question happened with the treatment of chickens, egg-laying chickens, a couple years ago, and decided, well, the chickens need a little bit more room than being all smashed up in one cage, and that seemed to go just fine. This question sort of has the same idea. How is the pork that we're raising for food, the pigs that we're raising for food, how much space do they get? How much fresh air do they get?
You know, where I get stuck on this question is, okay, this proposition was voted on in California, and it didn't win by a tiny little bit. It won by a rather resounding margin. And so the people in California democratically voted that, yes, we would like to do this and not have pigs sold in our state that are raised in gestation crates. Seemed very straightforward, democratic. Okay, we voted on this, and this is the will of the people. But now it's apparently not good enough. We can't just decide this as amongst ourselves. We have to have the industrial experts. So it's been taken through the courts, and it has arrived at the Supreme Court. And with the industrial pig producers are saying that this is going to be basically not good for their industry. Or what are they complaining about, John? Just not having 100% of the market or something?
Well, you know, exactly what they're doing, is nothing I can address directly because I'm not involved. But, you know, essentially what they're doing is saying that, oh, you know, it's going to cost a lot to, have enough room to group house females. I mean, that's essentially what the alternative is. If you can't put them in stalls or crates, well, you're going to have to group house them. And they're always arguing it's going to be hard on small farmers. Well, you know, the reality is that most of these big sow farms are not owned by small farms. There probably are a few around, but you know, the bulk of them are either owned by large integrators or they're owned by the packers. Particularly the four primary packers that are killing over 80% of the of the hogs in this country. So. Their argument tries to always hide, they like to hide behind the skirt of the small farmer. That's their go-to shield. And, the reality is it's very disingenuous.
Well, the other problem I have with it is the California market is what, less than 15% of the domestic market. And apparently enough hogs are raised without gestation crates to satisfy this market. Now, they still have 85% of the market, and nobody's telling them how to raise the pigs. Plus, large amounts of American pork are sold to the Chinese, and they don't have rules about that either. So why all this grousing just for 15% of the market? What are they afraid everybody's going to want to eat this kind of pork? Hello?
Well, that's, like I said, they have to make sure that nobody thinks that there's any other way to do it besides the way they say they have to do it. And, you know, that's the only real conclusion that I can come to. But like I said, I'm not involved in, you know, in crafting their arguments. But, you know, the reality is the system that, you know, the approach that industrial people have always, you know, always taken, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's, you know, raising pigs or, you know, milk or dairy or beef, you know, they say, oh, this is the way we have to do it. And essentially what they're admitting to is that they have structural problems, you know, and we all know what structural problems are. They're the ones that are very hard and very expensive to fix. You know, when you go to buy a vehicle, you want a Carfax. You know, when you buy a house, you get a, you know, home inspection, because you're trying to figure out what those structural problems are that you're getting involved in. And, you want to avoid them. Well, the industrial system, they always argue is, oh, it's so efficient. Well, what they're doing is conveniently, you know, ignoring the fact that, you know, there are a lot of externalities, and those are the structural issues that we're talking about. We're talking about the problems that, you know, because of the system, you end up putting too much manure on a lot of acres, and you end up with water quality problems. I mean, it's a structural issue that you're storing, you know, millions of gallons of manure, you know, in great huge, you know, pits or tanks.
Lagoons, they're called, yeah.
You know, that smells bad and creates a lot of methane and other greenhouse gases, you know, and that's a structural issue. It's a structural issue that says, you know, we're gonna grind all the feed and ship it 20, 30, 40 miles to where it's going to be consumed, rather than having it, you know, be taken out of a crib or a bin and ground on the farm and fed on the farm, you know. And those are all, you know, what you know, are coming under the classification of structural issues.
Well, I have talked to a friend who has a good legal background, and she was saying that the way they've structured this case at the Supreme Court, you know, it's not about is it moral or not to raise pigs in gestation crates, but something to do with the Interstate Commerce Clause. So, John, do you have any understanding of that, what they're resting their argument on?
Well, all I know is that, you know, that the what they call the Commerce Clause, you know, essentially, you know, was an attempt to keep, you know, one state, you know, from passing laws that would infringe on others. And now, from what little I've been able to discern, they are really not saying that you can't raise any pigs, you know, using gestation crates. They're only saying that, you know, we want ours raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that may be the end around on this particular argument. And like I said, it's really tough to know. But the general commerce clause that I'm familiar with just is, you know, was an attempt to, you know, keep lawmakers in one state from dictating, you know, what you do in another state. It's, you know, it's like us saying, well, all the cotton has to be raised in North Dakota. Well, you wouldn't have any cotton then. You know, that's kind of, you know, a situation where you might run into, you know, restrictions or, you know, at the time that was written, there were just a handful of colonies up in area. States up and down the East Coast. So, you know, their attempt at that point was different than what we have now. And that's one of the problems of, you know, you run into when you try and figure out original intent, which seems to be the vogue, legal mindset right now.
Yes. Right. It's yes. Yes. One could say it's in fashion at the Supreme Court at the moment. John, can you also speak to, since we're talking about legal issues, a little bit about the Iowa struggle to have any kind of, what is it, the laws, we're trying to get laws that say that a community can decide whether or not, where the confinement operations are located, and we've been unable to do that in Iowa. Are you following that story at all?
Well, you know, the argument has gone on clear back into the 80s about local control, and that's what you're talking about.
Because,
you know, the whole objective of, you know, property rights, and that's really what it comes back to, is, you know, do you have a right to control, you know, what is done with your property or done to your property? And quite frankly, this country is built on the foundation of, you know, people having security in their property rights, because, you know, a lot of the people, particularly the early people who came here, you know, had no access or no rights to property in, you know, Northern European countries, and they came here for property. And so the idea that you can have some sort of security in your property is pretty fundamental to, you know, what this country was built on. And the state basically, way back in the, you know, when the legislation got passed on the, you know, controlling these confinements, you know, essentially said, well, we can't have multiple, you know, county rules or multiple rules, so we'll just have one state rule. The problem is the state rule was pretty ineffective and has been hamstrung and gutted quite a bit since then. So, you know, right now we have, to my knowledge, I'm not sure we have many people going out and actually inspecting, you know, most of these facilities, like, you know, unless there's a spill or a problem. So, you know, that really tells me that, you know, the whole argument about, you know, doing things from the state level down has really been a ruse to say you can do whatever you like.
So the interested parties in maintaining this are the same people that are complaining at the Supreme Court, right? The large industrial pork producers.
Yeah, that's really, you know, that's really about who the only, you know, they're the ones that are calling the tunes right now on a lot of these things. So
they must have some very good lawyers.
Yeah. Well, it seems this is,
you know, and is oftentimes the problem. It's not necessarily always your lawyers as much as it is, you know, who your political patronage is going to.
That's true. It seems there's a lot of intersection between how we use our land, how we use our, well, like you said, property rights, but how we use the land, because there's also things like that can encroach on your land and well-being, like
The water moves around, the air moves around,
pesticide drifts, and that ends up in the courts, and the pipelines going across Iowa, that ends up in the courts. We kind of have to decide how, not so much who owns what, but exactly what we want done to the earth around us. This issue is not going away, and I certainly hope that people are free to spend with their money what kind of pork they want to buy.
Yeah, it looks like how you spend your money as an eater might have more influence than what you do at the ballot box. That's rather unfortunate.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I still think it's critically important that people, you know, as they used to say in Mayor Daley's Chicago, vote early and vote often, you know. But by all means, vote. You know, that's critically important, but. You know, I think you've hit on a really, really important point, and a lot of times I like to make sure that when we talk about what we do on our farm, that we are able to talk about the connection between, you know, what we do and how we take care of the land and how we support our local communities. And I think it's really important that we not lose sight of the fact that the people around us, even though we may not agree with them, you know, on politics or religion or what kind of vehicles to drive, are still the people that we have to rely on, when the chips are down. And, they're going to be the people who come put your fires out. They're going to be the people who, drive the ambulance. Or in many cases, you may be one of those first responders and, you're not going to pick and choose, whose fire you go to put out or whose ambulance call you choose. We have to rely on the people that are around us. And a lot of times we work with, people we don't necessarily agree with to try and find common ground to run, school boards, to run, county and city governments, to run volunteer organizations, to run, civic groups. And so all these things are critically important that we maintain, the strength and the structures of our communities. And one of the biggest, we have, quite frankly, in particularly in rural Iowa, two of the biggest challenges we're facing right now are, food security and affordable housing. Mm. And that's a long ways away from Prop 12, but, it's really important to see that we see our big picture items. And I think it's important to note that, in a recent survey that was done, by Dave Swenson before he retired,
at ISU, experiment.
Showed that pigs raised using the NIMA system not only returned more income to the local economy, but they actually employed about 2.5 times as many people as the industrial system. And I know back in the early days of industrialization, the Center for Rural Affairs did a survey that said for every job. And that was the motivation that Branstad and a lot of the Republicans had when they, gave industrialization a carte blanche, was that, they're creating jobs. Well, the center showed in their research that for every, job they were creating, they were eliminating 8 jobs in, traditional systems. So, mm-hmm. If you want to rebuild communities, we have to rebuild our rural communities in the Midwest, and particularly in Iowa, from the soil up. And, we have to have healthy soils. And a lot of times you can't build a healthy soil using the kind of system that comes with industrial hog production.
Good. You've given us a lot to talk about today, John, and thank you for being with us. John Gilbert is a longtime farmer. He has a farm in Hardin County called Gibraltar Farms. He and his family raise pigs for the Nyman Ranch group that seeks to raise pigs humanely and give us a good product, too. And we've been talking about Prop 12.
California Prop 12.
California Prop 12 that some people are kind of pushing against it. Actually, John, I guess that means things are working if people are kind of complaining about what you're doing. That's pretty much how it goes, I think. Anyway, thank you for being with us today, John.
And thank you for your wisdom from long-term farming. So good to have you on the show.
It's been my pleasure.
Good, thank you. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this fine radio station and Donna Lana Kitchen by going to www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're moving from pork to tomatoes, which actually is not a very big step because this time of year, I suppose you do that is too if you have a garden. There's those tomatoes that aren't quite ripe when you pick them because the frost is coming, and the ripening on your counter, This week, I kind of had what I considered the last of my bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. I mean, you have all good things come to an end, and using a good garden tomato and making a bacon, lettuce, tomato sandwich out of that, that's a good thing, and that's what I did this last week. So the connection between
Pork and the tomatoes.
Pork and tomatoes. There we. Anyway, Donna, how's that for a segue? That's a segue. Yeah. We are going to talk about, Donna's going to give us a report. We had a show about some recipes that you were excited about.
Well, this started back with our Ukrainian show, which was months and months ago. We had a Ukrainian cookbook that we were reading, and in the Ukrainian cookbook was a recipe for pickled tomatoes. And also, I had been taken by my Georgian friend Paula and Gio to it's an Eastern European food store in Des Moines, and we got jars of pickled tomatoes, and I thought, what a concept. How can I have gone my whole life and not eaten a pickled tomato? So it's a tomato that tastes like a pickle, but it's a tomato, you know. So we decided, Lana and I, that we were going to pickle some tomatoes this summer when they were in season. And we did it. And I used this recipe from the Ukrainian cookbook that we had talked about on air. I'm sorry, do you remember the name of the book?
Mamushka.
Mamushka, right.
Which I think is Ukrainian for grandmother? Something like that.
Anyway, she, the author, Olia Hercules or something.
Hercules,
like, yes. Had a recipe for fermenting the tomatoes in with a bunch of herbs, garlic, dill, et cetera. And then you have to leave them sitting, you know, it's like making sauerkraut. You have to leave them sitting for a while, 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. So we finally completed the process, and we tasted them about a week ago, and it was very interesting. What did you think of them, Lana?
Well, you had two experiments, as I understand it, because one I liked and one was kind of like, yeah, this is a pickled tomato, but the other one I really liked. One of them you said had vinegar in it, and the other one was just
pure fermentation.
Pure fermentation, and I liked that one. They were different. They were, well, they had this zing to them that I really enjoyed. I remember picking out small to medium tomatoes for you early on. What did you do this in August, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We started it in August, and we just ate them last weekend.
Very good.
And you use the smaller tomatoes because you can pop the whole tomato in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And Gio, our Georgian friend, says, this is what you do. You put the whole tomato in, you let it pop in your mouth, and then you don't really eat the skin. Kind of, it's like with an olive where you spit the pit out. Mm-hmm. So with the tomato, you kind of crush it in your mouth and you get that burst of flavor, and then you don't eat the skin.
Yeah.
And it was good.
Yeah, they were great. I could see, as relishes to go with things. Pickled tomatoes, and they are very pretty. I remember giving you a whole stash of, now this was early in the tomato season, so I picked small tomatoes. I have a variety that I grow called Marion, which is a smallish red tomato, and I grow it because it's pretty much foolproof, even though they didn't, because we had a drought this year, not too good in the tomatoes as far as Marion is concerned, but that's small Marion, small St. Pierre.
No, but they're bigger than a cherry tomato.
Yeah, bigger than a cherry, a kind of ping pong ball size. And there was a paste tomato that I got from Seed Savers Exchange called Grandma Mary's Paste Tomato, which for me didn't get super big, so that was a good size. And I had some small green zebras.
We did multiple ones, but... I mixed all the kinds of tomatoes in the jar, and then as we were tasting them, we figured out which ones we liked the best, and I kept saying, Lana, what variety is that?
As if I could remember.
Was it the...
Green zebra was great.
Right, but there was the red one that you... I said, remember that variety, so we'll do that next year.
That was the... It was the small paste tomato, and probably because it had a lot of meat in it. A lot of... as opposed to being a real gushy tomato.
A lot of flesh in it,
A lot of flesh in it, yes. Also, I grew Ukrainian blacks because of the Ukrainian recipe, mm-hmm. and that is also a more dense paste or long pear-shaped paste mm-hmm. tomato.
But they got a little large for
yeah,
the one
bite.
Yeah,
they got a little large. So,
sensation.
Yeah. So, and there was some yellow ones, too, which I don't remember what they are, but they were probably Lillian's yellow because that's about the size of Lillian's mm-hmm. yellow. But anyway, we had good luck with that one kind of paste tomato and the smaller green zebras. They were all quite dandy.
Well, in the cookbook, because not only did I use her recipe, but I also looked all over the internet, and even a listener sent in something that they found about recipes, and so that's why I tried variations on it. And you know, I am not the world's most experienced fermenter, but this went really smoothly. So I will be trying it again. And as we refine it, you know, maybe by next year we can pass the recipe along in case somebody else wants to try it. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly pickled when it's fermented. It doesn't have that vinegar flavor to it.
Well, yeah, one of your varieties or one.
One of them had
vinegar
and one of them didn't.
So, yeah. And
you like the non-vinegar one?
I like the non-vinegar because it was, well, yeah,
it's salty, and it's kind of fizzy, and you do put a lot of herbs in it, and you put in it, okay, it said in the Ukrainian cookbook and a few other places I found, there are certain things that they stick in the jar that have tannins that keep things from being mushy, and those are horseradish leaves, which I had in my garden, black currant leaves, and sour cherry leaves.
Great.
So I put all of them in.
Yes. You can do that with grape leaves, too, sometimes. Other pickle recipes, especially dill pickles, occasionally you say, be sure to put a leaf in. It's some of that kitchen magic that it's just good to pass along.
It worked.
Yes, it
worked. So we enjoyed ourselves thoroughly, and we will be doing this again.
Yeah. So there.
We're not going in the pickled tomato business, however. This is something everybody's going to have to experience for themselves.
Yes. So goodbye to the tomato garden, but hello to the pickles that are on the shelf.
And thank goodness we can have pork all year long.
Oh,
bacon forever, right?
Sounds good. Thanks to farmers like John Gilbert and the Nyman Ranch folks for giving us good, humanely raised meat. And
I have to say, you know, we love Nyman Ranch, but there are other companies that have similar models. Not all pork is raised conventionally.
That's true. Read the labels and support your eating habits with your conscience too. You can do this. We can do this. Well, I want to remind you that there's some upcoming things happening, including in Iowa. Early voting starts tomorrow, the 19th. So
yes, as John Gilbert said, vote early and vote often.
I often like that. Yes, I like to remind people to do that. But I want to mention that the Central Iowa Barn Dance has a barn dance this weekend, Saturday, October 22nd, 7:30 to 10 p.m. at 130 South Sheldon Avenue, which is one block south of the Dunkin' Donuts on Lincoln Way. Turn south on Sheldon Avenue.
And Lana is the dance caller.
Yes. And the Barn Owl Band will be playing music, and we'll have a good time. It's a good thing to do in the fall. You can look for the orange fiddling pig at the door. So, this has been the Donna Lana Kitchen, and we want to thank you for supporting this radio station and for listening. We appreciate being in your ears every Tuesday. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We had music by the Barn Owl Band. Support this fine community radio station, and you can listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen live at noon every Tuesday, or repeated at this radio station, 7 p.m. in the evening.
We have a podcast. So wherever you listen to podcasts, the interview that we did live today on Tuesday, by Thursday will be in a podcast.
Good. You can find us, Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.